orifice. Passing through the great gallery, Mia Ausa was just wondering why there was blood on the floor when a voice commandeered all of her attention. "Miss Ausa, there you are." She looked up to see Darth Venger standing a dozen yards away, his feet apart, arms folded. He looked calm, confident. Mia didn't think she liked that. A moment later, she knew she didn't, as a double line of his Black Rose apprentices appeared behind him, fanning out to either side and blocking the full width of the gallery. She knew without turning that another group had just entered through the main doors, cutting off any line of retreat. A few of those by Venger looked battered, bruised, as if they'd already been in one fight today, but they all had that menacing deadness in their eyes that she associated with poorly tutored flirtation with the dark side of the Force. "I require your answer in the matter we discussed some time ago," said Venger pleasantly. Mia looked casually behind her, conveying a faint sense of boredom with her body language. "I know they're there," the gesture said. "I only want to get a look at them." But a jet of real shock almost made her break character as she saw, in the lead of that second group, the youngest of the Kaneko warlords. He, too, looked bruised, his elaborate armor scuffed, and there was a slightly grudging sneer on his face, as if he didn't really want to be there. "A favor called in, then," she concluded. "It's no use looking for your little ninja friend," Venger told her, misinterpreting the glance back. "She's in Midgard, running errands for our self-styled Black Prince. She can't rescue you this time." He smiled slightly. "Now, to business. Your answer, please." Mia took a couple of slow, casual steps toward him, producing her collapsed Den Bok from within her robes. When she'd reached the exact center of the gallery, she stopped, squared herself to him, and said calmly, "With regret, Lord Venger, I shall have to decline your very generous offer." Venger narrowed his eyes slightly. "Unfortunate," he said. "A very short-sighted decision." He ignited his lightsaber. So, too, did several of his more advanced students, while the rest drew their black iron swords. "Also your last," he added, beginning to walk toward her.
"I thought you might say that," said Mia.
She triggered her weapon, which sprang to its full length with its characteristic singing rasp, and prepared herself. As she had feared, they were all approaching. Plainly, they weren't going to leave this matter to their master and merely block her escape routes. She began pre-casting her best battle augmentation spell in her mind, so that all she would have to do was speak the last word when they broke and rushed her. That would save her perhaps 4 seconds, which might be 4 seconds longer than she would otherwise live. An instant before Venger would have broken into a run, a voice addressed them all from behind the Sith Lord. "You might want to rethink this strategy, Roger." Venger froze, then whirled to see Kyoichi Sionji standing in the open far door, his own lightsaber in hand but not yet lit. Gathered around him was a third group of students, these belonging to the Mikage faction, armed and evidently spoiling for a fight. At the other end of the gallery, the main doors boomed open again, and in strode the armored figures of Shutan's fellow Masho, none of them looking particularly amused. Anubishu, in particular, betrayed a cold fury as he passed through the line of Venger's students as if they weren't there, and addressed his apprentice.
"Shutan, this is none of your affair."
The younger warlord began, but the elder cut him off.
"I know. You owe Venger a favor for his help earlier today."
His gauntleted hand flashed out and seized Shuten by the throat, lifting him from the floor, and Anubishu's visage was terrible indeed to behold as he raised Shuten's face level with his and went on,
"His help in exceeding my instructions. His help in taking the coward's way out."
Furiously, he dashed the young man to the floor like a man throwing down a bad hand of cards.
"His help in dishonoring us all!"
"Don't kill him," said still another voice from the rafters above, startling everyone, even Anubishu a little, in the room. All looked up to see a figure silhouetted among the shadows. Then Anakin Skywalker dropped lightly down, landing next to Mia. His stone right hand struck the floor with a sound like a shotgun blast, sending a spiderweb of cracks in the marble raying out from the point of impact. A moment later, Lena sprang down beside him. Straightening, the young man cricked his neck, rolled his right shoulder, and went on, "That's my job." Then he glanced back over his shoulder at Mia. "All right." "So far," she replied, smiling slightly. Shuten struggled to his feet, still a bit stunned from his impact with the floor.
How can you be back on your feet? Where did you get that hand?"
"I've got friends in low places," Anakin replied. Shuten gritted his teeth, then turned to Anubishu.
"I can atone for my earlier failure, Master," he said. "Let me kill him now."
Anubishu frowned.
"I hardly think Lord Trigon would appreciate that."
"Oh, let the boy prove himself, Anubishu," said Rajara with a smirk. "You and I both know Trigon's approval is irrelevant at this point. Our work here is nearly complete."
The Masho leader growled under his breath, then turned to Shuten.
"Very well. Destroy him. Do not fail me again."
"I won't," Shuten promised. Stepping away from his master, he uncoiled the chain of his Kusari Gama from around his body and started its weighted end whirling. Anakin took a step away from Mia and Lena, reached to his back, and unlimbered the greatsword he'd found when he'd first sparred with the latter. The two women eased away, edging to the side so that they could clear the center of the gallery without moving toward Venger. Sayanji walked around to join them, passing students of Venger who were so intent on what was happening that they didn't even think to try and stop him. For his part, the Sith Lord stood transfixed with fury, but also fascination, at this blatant upstaging of his big moment. This wouldn't get him any closer to possessing the half-caste Minbari, he supposed, but it was sure to be interesting, and it would probably rid him of yet another impediment.
"Did you hear?" Shuten demanded as he advanced toward Anakin. "No more games. Your doom approaches."
Anakin grinned nastily. "You've tried that once today and only made me stronger," he said. "And you know the best part? This new hand." He fitted his greatsword into his stone hand, which closed around the grip as though made to hold it. The blade glinted an opalescent deep violet, contrasting subtly with the blue-black of the stone. For a second, the two young men stood glaring at each other, Shuten's face a mask of fury within his helmet, Anakin's alight with a faintly malicious glee.
"It's a fightin' hand," young Skywalker declared as he commenced his attack.
1547 hours GST, 3:27 p.m. DSM time, Hannibal Hamlin Hall.
"Miss Sterling," said Professor Kesselring in surprise. "I wasn't expecting to see you back here until D-term, considering."
"As soon as my bag's packed and everyone else is checked out of the fourth floor, I'm off," Kaname assured him.
"Ah, ever dutiful," said the professor with a twinkle. "Well, you take care of yourself, young lady. No more adventures."
Kaname went a little red. "Does everybody know?"
she wondered.
Kesselring smiled.
I'm your building's faculty in residence, he told her. It's my job to know.
He tapped the side of his beaky nose with a bony forefinger and winked.
Just put your sign-out form under my door if I'm not here when you leave. See you after break.
After parting from the professor, she didn't speak again until they reached her room, at which point she said,
Well, here it is. Just like last time you saw it, except without as many spy gadgets.
Then, with slightly forced casualness, she went on,
So, listen, my family's going to Jezebel for spring break. Normally we do it in the summer, but it got moved up this year. I may have forgotten to mention this before, on account of I might have been planning to ditch you under the Outside the Bahava L System clause in the protocol, but after what just happened...
She hesitated, not quite sure how to say the next part, then went on in a rush.
It'd be okay with me if you wanted to come along, so you should probably go pack for the beach.
Sosuke took all that on board, then replied with a trace of regret. I can't go.
Wait, what? What do you mean you can't go? Is it your English lit final? I bet you have to make it up. I told you to study harder.
Sosuke shook his head gravely. Negative, Miss Chittery. I've been recalled by the central office to report for debriefing in light of current events.
Oh.
Kaname's voice trailed off, momentarily at a loss for words. While it had just recently been acknowledged by her mind and heart that Sosuke Sagara was a soldier and a warrior, apparently they both had forgotten that he answered to somebody else in the hierarchy, and eventually he would have to account for his actions.
Now that she thought about it, who did he report to?
She had no idea, aside from the general name of his security company and its parent. She'd never seen him take time off to report to somebody else earlier in the term, when there had certainly been enough weirdness going on. So why now?
Kaname shook her head, returning herself to the here and now. All right, fine, she said brusquely, as she verified that another student was ready to depart before returning to her own packing. So how long will you be gone?
Was it her, or was there a brief moment of hesitation before he continued? Most likely the full 2 weeks. Commercial travel to the corporate sector is not optimal at the best of times, and given the circumstances, I am unable to arrange for sponsored transport.
Oh. Well?
Her mind scrambled for some sort of appropriate reply, and even the collective didn't appear to have any good ideas right at the moment.
Good luck, I guess.
Thank you, Miss Chittery. Kaname's expression then turned stern, and she waggled a finger at him.
And you better be back on time for D-term. Comprende, Mr. Military? I don't want to have to explain to all my friends again and again and again where you wandered off to.
There was the faintest hint of a smile as Sosuke replied, Of course, Miss Chittery. GST, 3:02 p.m. Tau City time, Tau City 4. Around the back of Government House was an extensive semi-formal garden, and by some miracle it had remained untouched amid the chaos of the coup and counter-coup that had swirled around the building for the last day. Anthy spent a pleasant half-hour or so meandering aimlessly around its gravel paths, remarking to herself on the skill and diligence of the presidential groundskeepers. Here and there she encountered other duelists who had also found the place conducive to their desire for rest or just quiet. She discovered Caitlin, Sergei, and Juniper sitting under one of the latter's namesake trees, sunk deep in meditation. Well, possibly Serge was napping. In another place she found Keiko Sonoda stretched out on a bench, fast asleep. Out at the far end of the garden, a thrice life-size statue of a winged woman with her arms upraised in triumph
stood overlooking a grassy ridge that sloped down through unorganized woods to the city below. There, Anthy found two of the contingent from Gerardo, and a smile touched her face as she stood and regarded them. Amy Pond and her boyfriend, whose name momentarily escaped Anthy, sat propped against the marble base of the statue, wrapped in the red cloak he'd worn during the battle, their heads leaning together in sleep. They were quite the cutest thing Anthy had seen in some time. She didn't know Amy well. The redhead was a sophomore, so she'd arrived at DSM well after Anthy's time, and they'd met only on alumni days. But she liked her. The dauntlessness and honesty of her had a certain pleasant resonance. Anthy seemed to recall having heard that Amy was from Scotland itself, not one of the Scottish Crown colonies, and as such must have run a considerable gantlet just to attend DSM in the first place. She turned to leave the pair to their rest, then pulled up short as she first noticed, then recognized, the blonde figure who stood at the end of the path leading back into the garden proper.
"Nanami," she whispered.
"I need to talk to you," Nanami said. Anthy put a finger to her lips for quiet and went to Nanami's side, urging her out of earshot of the statue.
"People are trying to sleep,"
she explained to Nanami's puzzled look.
"Oh," said Nanami in a quieter voice, retreating a little way up the path. I had heard that you were alive again," said Anthy hesitantly. "Corwin said he'd seen you at Christmas."
Nanami's pale cheeks went a trifle pink.
Yes, she said. He did a bit."
"You don't need to mince any words with me, Nanami," Anthy told her. "Corwin doesn't conceal such things from me or Utina." She smiled slightly. "I'm not sure he could."
"Ah." Nanami thought this over. "Actually, I think you just made me feel more awkward."
"You shouldn't," Anthy said. "Under the circumstances, it was a great act of kindness. And..." She hesitated, choosing her words carefully, then went on. "I think I may understand your reasons for doing it." With a wry little smile, she added, "Two of them, anyway."
Nanami was unable to restrain a little snort of laughter at that.
"Yeah, I suppose you would, wouldn't you?" she asked rhetorically. "Anyway, you're probably wondering what I'm doing here."
"A bit, yes," Anthy admitted.
"Well, it depends on who you ask," Nanami said. "If you ask my boss, he'd say I'm supposed to sow doubt and discontent among you. Approach one would be bragging about, what you already know about, so that wouldn't have worked anyway. Approach two, well, you don't need me to draw you a diagram." She paused, her fists clenching, eyes closed as if in sudden pain. "There's a compulsion in me, part of what makes me what I am now. It drives me to do just that. It's gnawing at my guts right now, as I speak to you. But I'm not going to give in to it."
Her smoke-gray eyes snapped open, fixing on Anthy's with a sudden blazing fierceness.
"I refuse."
Anthy's expression was an even mix of compassion and dismay, but not pity. Nanami was hypersensitive to pity these days, and by the grace of some forgotten god, there wasn't any there, as she put a hand on the blonde's shoulder and whispered her name.
"What I'm going to do instead," Nanami went on in a low, over-controlled voice, "is betray my master."
She reached up and seized Anthy's hand.
"You must be on your guard. Don't underestimate the thing that was your brother,
because he's so, so much more now than he was when you killed him. He hates you and all you love with a passion that moved the great fire himself. Think of that, Nanami whispered, her face gone bone white with dread now. A hatred so pure that the enemy of all perceives it as beauty. That's how he came to be Duke of Sheol in the first place. That's what's arrayed against you now. I know you think he came to your lover's wedding just to trouble you, Nanami went on, but you're wrong. He came to warn you, to show you that he'll never rest until he's taken away everything you've come to care about since you escaped his thrall, until he's taught you what loss is. Nanami winced and closed her eyes again, tears leaking out. I can't say any more, she gasped. I think he knows I've said this much. It's... Ah! She cried, nearly bending double. Anthe reached for her, but Nanami waved her back. No, no, it's all right. I'm all right. It's just... the recall hurts. Particularly if you resist. Anthe pushed aside her hands and took hold of both her shoulders. Nanami, she said intently, listen to me. We'll go to Corwin. We'll go right now. He's one of the Aesir. He can give you sanctuary. Break the hold Akio has over you. She shook her head. I can't imagine why he didn't think of it at Christmas. He did, Nanami said through gritted teeth. But too late. He thought I wouldn't accept. She actually managed a laugh of sorts at that. Sentimental fool. As though I have it in me to take offense at being treated like what I am. She straightened herself, gasping, and took hold of Anthe's elbows. Her gray eyes now unfocused with pain, she met Anthe's horrified gaze as best she could, and told her, Too late for me now. Forget me. But don't forget what I've told you. Nanami! Anthe cried, but Nanami was gone, slipping through her fingers like smoke. With the sudden vanishing of the resistance against her hands, Anthe nearly lost her balance, recovering with a sort of hopping step backward. Tears came to her eyes as she regarded the spot where the blonde had just been. That's twice, she thought. Twice Nanami has put herself in harm's way to warn me. Twice she's suffered for it, possibly even twice she's died for it. In older days, Anthe might have been overcome with grief and self-reproach at that realization, but that had been a long time ago. Now she felt only a steely sort of resolve settle over her. No more, she thought, straightening her spine, clenching her fists at her sides. No more. Anthe? Said a voice behind her. Is something wrong? She turned to see Amy and Rory, that was his name, standing at the mouth of the path, looking concerned. Was that you shouting? Rory asked. It's... Anthe paused, took a deep breath, and let it out slowly. Thank you, she said. It's hard to explain. I'm all right, but I've just learned that a friend is in terrible trouble. Anything we can help with? Amy asked. I doubt it, at least right now, said Anthe, but thank you. There may come a time. Any time you need us, said Rory. You just ask. Absolutely, Amy agreed. We're here to help. Orifus.
Anakin didn't know about Invincible, but after throwing down with Shuten Doji, he could definitely say that the Hand of Wrath made its owner feel pretty damn badass. Oh, Shuten was tough, there was no doubt about that. He had that nearly indestructible armor, for one thing, whereas Anakin was dressed for a day in the dojo, rocking something very similar to the Jedi Padawan look he'd once worn as a matter of course. His weapon had a gigantic reach advantage, even over Anakin's enormous greatsword, mainly because it appeared to have some kind of freak-ass ninja magic going on whereby the chain would become as long as required for any given situation. Several times Shuten hurled the weighted end with such force that, when Anakin parried it, it nearly took the head off some hapless bystander or knocked a chunk out of the far wall. On the other hand, Anakin came to appreciate one of the hand's features very early on. It was a great, massive, heavy thing that would probably prove quite clumsy in everyday life. He was used to that, since his old cyber hand had been built by a one-handed slave out of junk in an aerotaxi garage and wasn't what you would call a precision instrument. In the day-to-day, it was probably going to be a bit annoying, but in a fight, it was better than a sledgehammer. Anakin had always been noted for his unusual strength, and once he got the feel of it, he barely noticed the hand's weight. But Shuten did, every time Anakin smashed it into him. That magic armor might be almost impenetrable, but Anakin didn't have to penetrate it to bounce the man inside it around a bit. He soon settled into a new style in which he handled the greatsword almost exclusively with his left hand, and let the hand do its own talking on the right. Ultimately, he wound up relying entirely on the latter, as a slightly mismanaged parry jangled the sword from his stinging hand and left it stuck in the floor near the middle of the room. Forced to leap away from a whistling sweep of the Kusarigama's bladed end, he was unable to retrieve it, and instead had to do a bit of a dance to keep from being Julienne. "Your life is over!" Shuten roared, whirling the weighted chain until it thrummed like a helicopter's rotors. "He can see things before they happen. It's a Jedi trait." Anakin's lips curled away from his teeth in a furious grin as Shuten loosed the weight again, sending it arrowing straight for his head. He let it come, staring it down as if attempting to intimidate it. And then, an instant before it would have shattered his skull, he suddenly burst into motion and seized it with his stone hand. Sparks flew as the chain links shrieked across his palm in the moment before the fingers closed and halted its flight. The weight missed his head by an inch, hit the limit of its extension, and swung away, whirling outward. With a contemptuous flick of his arm, Anakin harnessed its momentum to take three turns of the chain around the Hand of Wrath, then set himself and pulled with all his might, yanking the bladed end from Shuten's startled hand. He let the chain unwind from his stone arm and fall to the floor, leaving the whole weapon piled in a useless heap at his feet. The young warlord stared at his opponent for a half second in shock. Then, his face contorting with fury, he drew a short-bladed knife, but before he had a chance to use it, Anakin was upon him. In 6 furious seconds, the young ex-Padawan had leveled him. Standing over his fallen, bloodied foe, Anakin put out his left hand. The Force tore his blade from the floor and delivered it to his grip. He whirled it through a completely superfluous flourish and put its tip under Shuten's chin. For a second, possibly 2, the room fell silent. Everyone watched to see what Anakin would do, the adults tense and curious, the students barely daring to breathe. From behind the other Kanikan warlords came the sound of slow, sarcastic applause. The warlords and Venger's students parted and drew back to make way as the slim, dark figure of Akio Otori advanced into the gallery, still clapping. Nanami Kiryu walked at his side, a pace or two behind, looking drawn and weary. "Nicely done, Mr. Skywalker, I believe you've made your point," he said casually, and then, in a slightly harder tone of voice, "Any student not in quarters within 5 minutes will be disciplined." Like magic, the crowd of students melted away and dispersed, all but Lena, who remained by Mia and Sayanji as they moved closer to the two fighters. Anakin held his position for a moment longer, then stepped back and withdrew his sword. Shuten struggled to his feet, holding one arm across his midsection. Even through his armor, he suspected that Anakin had cracked a few of his ribs and glared at him.
"You'll regret letting me live," he spat.
"I already regret letting you live," Anakin replied with a dark little smile.
"Now, now, gentlemen," said Akio dryly. "Surely there's no need for vendettas within our organization."
"Your organization is a farce," said Rajara. "You were gone for what, a day, two? And it all but completely fell apart. Your pet Sith Lord schemes against the Minbari witch, the green-haired madman plots against him, the students take sides, and that ineffectual fop of a wizard you left ostensibly in charge does nothing whatever."
Anubishu grunted agreement. "There was very nearly a war here today. It's merely luck that this other battle took place, and you didn't arrive to find this room strewn with corpses."
Akio gave him a faintly patronizing look. "You think it was mere chance that put Skywalker and your apprentice onto their collision courses?" He made a mocking, "you may have a point" sound, walked away from him, took hold of Anakin's stone hand, and examined it. "I see Mikage has been helping himself to my things. Well, never mind. You seem to be putting it to good use." He let the hand drop and patted the young man on the shoulder, adding with a friendly smile, "I shan't repossess it. And as for the rest of you..."
"Otori!" Anubishu barked. "We're not finished."
Akio wheeled, giving the warlord a mild look. "Aren't we? Your boy lost, but kept his head. It seems to me the matter is quite concluded."
"We are returning to Ishiyama," the Masho leader declared. "This exercise has been a waste of time."
"Ah," said Akio, unconcerned. "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but if that's what you feel you must do, I won't stand in your way. Do keep your signets. You're all welcome back here at any time, should you change your minds. We can still do great things together."
Anubishu snorted. "Masho, away!"
As the warlords left the gallery, the others could hear him growling to Shuten,
"I will deal with you once we're back in Kaneko."
Akio watched them go, then turned back to the others with a little sigh. "A shame," he said. "They could have been very helpful. Still, one has to make do with the material one is given." He paused, then crossed to stand before Lena. "Miss Tarrant," he glanced at his watch, "you now have only 45 seconds. Given where your quarters are, I don't think much of your chances." Lena went a little pale, but Anakin broke in. "She's with me. We were on our way to spar before... this." Akio turned back to him, gave him an appraising look, then nodded. "Of course. One imagines you're no longer in the mood for that." He smiled. "But that's your business. Carry on."
Thank you, Lord Akio," Lena stammered.
"Not at all. Always glad to see my students bettering themselves." Akio turned away from both of them, dismissing them utterly, and walked toward Venger. "Kyoichi, Mia, Lord Venger, we have to talk."
"Nice save,"
Nanami whispered to Anakin with a tired but saucy wink as she followed Akio to the far end of the gallery. "Let's get out of here," said Anakin to Lena,
and they went the other way. "We're not really going to spar, are we?" Lena wondered when they'd cleared the building.
"Pfft,"
Anakin replied. "Not bloody likely. All I want to do is go find a tub and soak for an hour, and then maybe eat a sandwich about the size of my head."
"That sounds good to me," Lena agreed.
On impulse, she took his arm. She was on his right, so that arm ended in the stone hand, which she ran her fingers over thoughtfully.
"I can feel that, you know," he said. "It's magic."
"Oh, sorry."
"I didn't say I didn't like it," he added with a faint grin.
"Hand of Wrath, huh? Professor Mikage said it was part of a set. I wonder if there's one for each of the deadly sins. If so, you're lucky you didn't get the Hand of Sloth."
She giggled.
"Or the Hand of Lust, though personally I'd be okay with that."
Anakin glanced sidelong at her, unsure how to take that remark, then laughed.
"17:05 GST, Blue Sector IPO Office Complex, Babylon 6.
"So I understand the kids did all right," Maya Sterling remarked.
Griffin nodded.
"Not bad at all."
"Most satisfactory," as my old Kenjutsu master liked to phrase his highest praise.
"That isn't the face of a commander who's had a job turn out most satisfactory," said Vince Grant thoughtfully.
With a rueful chuckle, Griffin admitted, "It's not dissatisfaction, just preoccupation. The whole job was laid on in such a rush, and we had such a scramble at the top that I feel like I may not have given the task force all the tools it really needed. That Utena and her crew got the job done anyway is more a reflection on them than me. Not that I'm the kind of boss who gets grumpy about that," he added with a wry grin.
"How so?" Maya asked.
"Well, Utena hasn't had time to do a formal after-action report yet, obviously. Technically, the operation's not even complete yet. But from the sound of some of the preliminary info I've been getting, it seems like there were a few dicey moments. I gather Trident could really have used some destroyed coverage for the initial assault, rather than relying on getting the TCDF back up and running in short order. If that part of the plan had hit a snag, the whole thing could have come undone."
Griffin shrugged. "Sometimes these things can't be helped, I guess. I mean, with that aerospace cover, there's no way we'd have gotten a destroyed dropship through in the first wave."
Tessa Testarossa hadn't looked like she was really paying attention for most of the conversation, but now she suddenly looked up as if struck by an idea. Without explaining why, she tabbed her communicator and asked the Veronda Elendil's comm operator to beam her straight to her quarters, then vanished in a wash of energy. Griffin and the others looked at each other with faint bemusement for a few moments. Then she just as suddenly returned with a heavy armful of files, turned to the right, took one step, discovered that she'd beamed back a few feet closer to Griffin than she'd been expecting, and crashed full steam into him before she could stop herself.
"Well," said Griffin amiably from the floor, somewhere underneath the engineer and all the files. "This takes me back. It's just like being back on Nishiyama."
"Oh my goodness, Chief, I am so sorry," Tessa sputtered, sitting up and scattering folders and data solids further in the process.
"Ah, don't worry about it," Griffin replied, getting to his feet.
"You know," he mused as he crouched to help her pick up the papers, "this is why Lou keeps trying to get me to go paperless. Though, to be fair, it hasn't worked." One of the folders he was picking up had partly disgorged its contents. He moved to slide the documents back inside, noting as he did that they were technical diagrams of some kind, and then his practiced eye caught a few of the details and, instead of pushing it back into the folder, he took it the rest of the way out.
proposal for a trans-atmospheric, submersible, stealth-capable light destroyed carrier and assault craft. TDD-1, he read quietly. Arching an eyebrow, he went on in a low murmur, "What in the name of..." Still sitting on the floor, gathering up the rest of the documents, Tessa glanced away and reddened a little. It was a thought exercise. "Hmm," said Griffin abstractly. And then, as he took in more details of the general arrangement diagram, he said in a firmer voice, "Wow. This ship is a dessert topping and a floor wax." "Oh, man, the Tuatha De Danann," Maya said. "Damn, it's been a while since I last even thought of that." At Griffin's curious eyebrow, even as he continued looking at the specifications for the ship, she elaborated, "Back around the late 2360s, Mars Division had gotten big enough that we were starting to think about expanding our operations to more than just one ship and a home base. Especially with some of the missions we were executing, ones where having a Horizon transport as the delivery vehicle for the task force just wasn't cutting it." Vince picked up the thread. "So the idea was to shop around for something that could handle a small dropship carrier role for tactical insertions that would be easier to manage than the Elendil in hot locations. Yeah, I remember us going through the available ships at the time, but nothing seemed to really fit our needs. Man, the discussions we had about that." He shook his head. "And then Tessa here comes up to us with her idea." "It was a good idea," Miranda continued, in order to placate Tessa's mildly indignant expression. "And we had started saving up for it, even though building a ship from scratch with untested technologies would have cost a lot more than getting one out of the used starship lots. But then the Wedge Defense Force came back, and, well..." Maya shrugged apologetically. "The whole idea got shelved." "But it would have been perfect for the Tau Ceti operation," Tessa insisted. "The Tuatha De Danann could have performed the role that Seleucian U-ship played, then slipped past the Earth Force blockade and onto the planet before the main body of the Strike Force arrived. When the signal came to commence the surface assault, her arm slaves could have been on station within 10 minutes. Griffin flipped to another page of the diagrams, studied a couple of performance estimate tables, and then gave the engineer a speculative look. "She might have had more trouble running the blockade than you're assuming, and I'm not sure how much help a pair of arm slaves would have been in the opening phase of the ground fight." He smiled to forestall any disappointment his critical points might have caused and added, "But it would certainly have been worth a shot. And the thing about launching small destroids as IRBM payloads? That's brilliant." He closed the folder and handed it back to its owner. "I tell you what, Tessa, if you can't get Maya to pay for that, you come to me. I'll build it just to see if it works." Maya coughed. Tessa blinked in surprise and said, "But you're the busiest man in the galaxy." "If I'm ever too busy for crazy submarines, that'll be the day it's time to hang it all up," Griffin declared positively. 1712 hours GST, 5:12 p.m. DSM time, Hannibal Hamlin Hall. Being a meticulous sort of person, Kaname took her time packing. She'd had to kill a couple of hours while everyone else checked out with her for break anyway, and she'd used the time to get her suitcase packed exactly right, a skill of which she was rather proud, even if most of her friends considered it borderline neurotic. All that was left now was to hang up her old Jindai High uniform in the closet, since she wasn't taking it with her, and, with the checkout sheet fully completed and ready to be slipped under Professor Kesselring's door, she'd be good to go. As she was hanging the uniform up, she suddenly felt as if she had forgotten something. Something important. Or was that it? She hesitated, her hand still gripping the shoulder of the uniform jacket on its hanger, and tried to push her suddenly jumbled thoughts back into something like order. She felt anxious, as though something terrible were happening just beyond the corner of her eye. Without consciously knowing why, she ran down the deserted hall to the common room and switched on the television, which, like almost every other set on campus, was still tuned to Network 23. The breaking news graphic was still emblazoned across the top of the screen, and John Trussell was still speaking from the plaza in front of Government House in Tau City, now somewhat less strewn with rubble than it had been earlier. But he wasn't talking about the Tau City situation at all now. The text below him, bold and white, said it all. Federation President Santiago killed. She'd caught Truss just as he was restating the lead of the story, which he'd plainly gone through at least once already. The starship USS Danzig, a galaxy-class Starfleet battleship, had suffered some as-yet-unknown massive casualty while transporting United Federation of Planets President Luis Santiago and much of his cabinet on some errand of state. Kaname would realize later that Truss must have specified what the errand was, but she completely failed to retain the information, possibly because it was of such patent unimportance under the circumstances. Reports from the Starfleet Task Force investigating the site are still incomplete, but they state one fact unequivocally, Truss said. Whatever the cause, and it will be months before that can be named, the Danzig has been lost with all hands. President Santiago, Vice President Crane, and most of the Federation cabinet are confirmed dead. A spokesman for the Federation Senate would only confirm that legal machinery designed for just such an emergency is in effect now, and insisted that there will be, quote, no discontinuity of governance. Truss adjusted his glasses, took a single beat to collect himself, and then went on. At this time, we have no information as to who in the constitutional chain of succession remains, nor how long it will take for President Santiago's successor to be located and sworn in. The situation in Paris is, understandably, chaotic at the moment. To repeat, if you're just joining us, Kaname switched off the TV and stood in blank-faced thought for a second. Truss knew, of course. He was too smart and too well-informed not to know. He simply wouldn't say it on the air yet because it hadn't been officially confirmed. There had been a title and a name conspicuously absent from the list of those confirmed dead, and the former denoted a prominent place in the line of succession to the Federation presidency. Speaker of the Senate William M. Clark, senator from the Earth Alliance, former president of said alliance, and widely reputed still to be the silent power behind current EA President Greeley's chair. Architect of the 2406 crackdown and the 2405 extension to the Psi Act before it. Outspoken critic of the International Police Accords, the Babylon Foundation, and the IPO Psi-Core Détente Compromise of 2407. Staunch supporter of the movement afoot in the Federation Senate to abandon that compromise and fully federalize the Psi-Corps. Unashamed user of phrases like the Scion problem in public discourse. Coiner of xenophobic slogans that would have been hilariously corny if they hadn't been so disturbing. Earth for humans, let's keep it that way. Spirit, she thought. No wonder I'm on the verge of freaking out. I must still be a neurological mess from earlier, and now my father's entire species is collectively thinking, oh crap. She took out her cell phone and thumbed a speed dial code. The scratchy buzz of the other end ringing sounded twice in her ear, then cut off with a click and a crisply enunciated, Sagara. You, back here, now, Kaname said. There was an infinitesimal pause. Miss Chittery? Sosuke said, sounding faintly startled. What's happened?
I'm no longer on Gerardo. I'm back on Babylon 6. Now awaiting transport to...
I don't care where you think you're supposed to be going, damn you.
Kaname snapped, surprising herself with the on-the-verge-of-tears tone in her voice.
I need you. Wait where you are. I'll come to you.
Then, not waiting for him to protest further, if in fact he was going to, she cut the connection.
Now what in the hell did I do that for? She wondered, standing looking at the phone.
Then she shook her head, put it away, went back to her room for her suitcase, and left the dorm.
Hours GST, 4:22 p.m. Tau City Time, Tau City 4.
Utina signed off from a terse conversation with a very harassed-looking Starfleet captain, switched off the comm console, and walked slowly back across the Situation Room, her face deeply pensive. Corwin, who had made it over from TCDF HQ just in time to be there when she received the news of the Danzig's loss, followed her silently into the adjoining presidential quarters. There, seeing that Anthy was standing by the desk and the way was thus clear, she tossed herself backward onto the bed, sprawling full length in a single motion with her arms thrown wide, and sighed at the ceiling.
Okay, this is officially the second worst wedding reception in galactic history now, she declared.
What was the worst? Anthy wondered.
The Siege of Troy, replied Utina sourly. She propped herself up on her elbows, glowering around the room in a general dudgeon for a moment, then turned a wry half-smirk to Corwin and said,
Teach me to try and have a big formal day. Maybe we should just get Charlie to do it. He's the president of the planet. Surely he has the authority.
She looked up to see Wakaba Shinohara entering the room.
What do you think, Wakaba?
About what? Wakaba asked, having missed the beginning entirely.
I was just telling Corwin we should skip trying to restage the senior prom, Utina said, letting herself flop down on her back again. Just get President Callan to sign a form and call it a day.
Wakaba gave her a shocked look, then marched over next to the bed so she could lean over it and stare down at her, fists on hips.
I think you cannot be serious, she said sharply.
Utina blinked up at her.
Okay, so that's a no vote?
Wakaba wheeled on her heel and walked away from the bed, raising her hands in an exasperated gesture.
I can't believe after all this you'd think of just taking the easy way out like that.
Utina rose to her elbows again.
I was half kidding.
Wakaba spun back to give her an accusing look.
But half serious.
Wakaba, I'm tired, Utina said. We're all tired, and I think we're going to have a lot to do in the very near future, as are most of our guests. We can't expect...
The hell you can't, Wakaba blurted. Now more than ever, you've got to put on a show. In fact, she said with an abstract sweep of her hand, in light of what happened yesterday, you've got to go bigger.
You were the one who said we should call it off altogether, Utina protested, a trifle indignantly.
I was wrong, Wakaba cried, gesticulating. And you didn't listen to me anyway, which was good. Why are we yelling?
I don't know, Utina insisted, sitting fully up and crossing her legs.
She shot a vague glare at Anthy and Corwin, who had moved together near the door and were, in spite of the sobering nature of much they had learned in the last half hour or so, now leaning shoulder to shoulder, giggling as quietly as they could.
It's just that I know you're tired, but you've got an obligation, Wakaba said, slightly less heatedly.
I've been thinking about it all day, in between getting shot at.
The cooldown was short-lived. She started to pick up momentum and volume again as she went on.
an obligation not just to all the family and friends you have here, but everyone back home. The Pillar of Sephiro getting married? The last time something like that happened, the world ended.
She turned to Corwin. People are going to need reassuring, especially since you guys are gone most of the time.
Don't look at me, I fixed that, Corwin protested. Now I'm yelling too.
Utrina got up from the bed and approached her oldest friend, putting a placating hand on her shoulder.
Wakaba, calm down, she said, but that just made Wakaba spin once more to point accusingly up into her face.
It's not about you, and it's not about me, it's about every Sephirian, and don't tell me to calm down, she snapped.
They stood there making fierce eye contact for a few seconds. Then, virtually simultaneously, both women cracked up laughing and fell together in a powerful embrace.
Okay, okay, you made your point, Utrina said, then kissed Wakaba on the cheek and added, Drama queen.
She disengaged and stepped back, one hand behind her head.
So, now, as soon as the situation here is something like stable, we have to round up all our guests again on ridiculously short notice, and then convince them to do the retake in a pocket universe.
I think Clef just volunteered to put in some overtime, said Wakaba cheerfully.
Hours GST, 5:31 PM DSM time. Port Geradar Shuttleport. The bus stop. It was a mark of the kind of day, weekend at this point, Kaname was having that she arrived at the Port Geradar Shuttleport just in time to see the 5:30 to Babylon 6 leave without her. Sighing, she sat down on the bench in the waiting area and looked up at the flickering holo schedule on the opposite wall. The next one was scheduled in 9 minutes. At least they seemed to be running on time. 2 minutes later, another person entered. Kaname recognized her and was slightly surprised to see her. Tapar, one of DSM's handful of Vulcan students. Slim, dark-haired, and neatly but stylelessly groomed, like every Serakian Vulcan Kaname had ever seen. She wore dark, subdued street clothes, the first time Kaname could remember seeing her out of uniform, and carried a plain black nylon bag.
Oh, hi, Tapar, said Kaname.
The Vulcan girl inclined her head about 3 degrees.
Miss Sterling, she said.
I'm surprised to see you here, Kaname admitted.
Tapar arched an eyebrow.
Indeed?
Well, it's just that you're a duelist, Kaname said. I thought you were on Tau Ceti with the others.
Plainly not, said Tapar. There was a brief silence that, at least on Kaname's part, was slightly awkward.
Mind if I ask why not? Kaname finally said.
No, said Tapar. Another silence. Vulcan, thought Kaname after a moment's bafflement.
Right.
Why not? She asked.
Involving oneself in the armed conflicts of strangers is not logical, Tapar said flatly.
Ah.
Another silence.
So, where are you headed? Kaname wondered.
Vulcan.
Ah.
Tapar stood looking blankly off toward the vacant shuttle pad for a few seconds, then said suddenly, I am doing it again, aren't I?
Sorry?
You are using a conversational format which is meant to be sustained by the volunteering of extra information in response to follow-up questions which are implied by context but left unvoiced.
Tapar turned her head to regard Kaname with a faintly inquisitive look.
And I am failing to respond in the expected fashion, which is making you experience feelings of awkwardness and doubt.
Is this correct?
Well, yeah, that pretty much covers it, yeah.
Tapar nodded.
My apologies, she said. One of my fellow duelists routinely informs me that I am, quote, rubbish at the conversation thing, end quote.
Was that the very faintest hint of a sardonic smile? If so, it was gone almost instantly, as Tapar went on. In answer to your unvoiced follow-up question, I must consult with my parents and the Foreign Ministry regarding the advisability of remaining off Vulcan in the wake of today's astropolitical developments. I assume you are aware of the death of Federation President Santiago?
Kaname nodded.
His most likely successor is known to support draconian legislation affecting members of psionic populations. Like all Vulcans, I am significantly telepathic, Tapar went on. Should the compromise of 2407 be abandoned, and the mandate of the Psi Corps be expanded into the rest of Federation space, my situation could become awkward. I must inquire of those better placed to assess such matters as to the probability that this will take place before the end of the school year, and I prefer not to do so on an open interstellar communications channel. I am therefore going in person.
She arched her questioning eyebrow again.
Does that answer your question?
Quite comprehensively, Kaname said.
Excellent.
As silence fell once more, Kaname felt a surge of entirely irrational annoyance at how composed Tapar was. This was doubly silly in that she was a Vulcan, raised in the full Serakian tradition, and obviously composure was a thing with them. Still, her situation was a lot more uncertain than Kaname's, and yet there she was, coolly waiting for the bus, not knowing whether she was ever going to be back, and apparently just totally okay with that. It made Kaname feel a bit silly about the surge of panic she'd felt when she first heard the news, though she knew it was at least partially because of her wonky link to the Invid telepathic web. She was not a girl accustomed to having the vapors, and her whole response to the matter was starting to feel uncomfortably and embarrassingly like that. By the time she reached Babylon 6, she felt fully ridiculous. She almost calmed up Sosuke from the shuttle bay to tell him to forget the whole thing. But no, she'd told him she'd find him, and now she felt obligated to do just that. He was in the Trans-Enigma Space Line's departure lounge, awaiting the 615 to Omega, one of the few scheduled runs from B6 that would get him anywhere near the corporate sector. There was a lot of noise and hubbub. Apparently a gravity ball team from somewhere in the terminus was also making a connection at Omega, and from the sound of them they'd gotten good and ripped on the Zocalo before turning up for their flight. Kaname didn't envy the cabin crew, although if they were always on a scheduled run to Omega, she supposed they'd probably dealt with worse on a fairly regular basis. Sosuke rose as she entered the lounge, a flicker of concern crossing his face.
Miss Chittery, he said, you're just in time. My flight will be called any minute. What's the problem?
Kaname stood and looked at him for a moment. She almost asked him to stay anyway, make some excuse or another to his bosses, tell them that in light of what had just happened he felt it imprudent to leave her at this time, something like that. Then, remembering how she'd felt when speaking with Tapar, she told herself sternly to pull herself together and said,
"Never mind. It was nothing. You heard the news about the Danzig?"
Sosuke nodded.
"A great loss to interstellar statesmanship," he said, and seemed both to mean it and know what he was talking about, which surprised her slightly.
"Yeah, well, I don't know. The day I've had, I got a bit rattled."
She felt herself blush a bit at coming right out with that admission, but she felt he deserved the truth rather than bluster for once. For once, and maybe as a matter of policy, now that they'd seen Brown 21 together.
She filed that away for later consideration. Anyway, she went on with forced offhandedness, I'm better now. You get along to your big important meeting. I'll see you when school's back in. Yeah?
Of course. Assuming I'm not reassigned, I'll be there.
Kaname stared at him. That possibility had not even crossed her mind until he'd said it, and here she was making all these plans to consider changes in ongoing policy.
That's not likely, is it?
She asked. I very much doubt it is, Sosuke replied at once. If anything, recent developments may cause your security detail to be expanded. If that happens, there is a small chance that I'll be removed from the assignment and a whole new detachment sent in. But given my experience with the environment...
Shut up, she said suddenly, and hugged him. Just don't say anything.
Shutting up? He said after a moment's startled silence. The hug lasted a fairly long time, long enough that it left Sosuke entirely bewildered when she at last pulled away from him, which she did when the overhead voice announced the boarding call for Trans-Enigma 437, nonstop service to Omega. Better go, Kaname said briskly, back in command. Don't want to be the last one looking for a seat with all those grav-ball jerks on your flight. Miss Chittery, Sosuke said, but she was already propelling him toward the airlock. You're giving a report to your bosses, yeah? She said. Make it a good one. Tell them DSM can't possibly survive without you and your revolutionary campus security plan. Tell them anything you have to. Just be back in 2 weeks. Sosuke paused in the doorway, turned to face her, and saluted crisply, his face entirely professional, as it had been at their first meeting. Instructions received and understood, ma'am, he said. I will comply to the best of my ability. Sagara out. And then he was gone, and Kaname was casually punching out one of the hooting grav-ballers on her way out of the lounge, because she was in absolutely no goddamn mood to be hooted at. Head down, fists still clenched, she went straight across to the Gold Star Line lounge, where, as she had expected, she found several people she knew waiting for the 625 to New Avalon. Okay, she said. Who wants to come to Jezebel with me? If Bill Clark is going to be president of the Federation, I'd say we've all earned a week at the beach. Avery Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a duelist opera, third movement, first dates, and firefights. Orifice. Akio Otori entered the headmaster's office in a bit of a dudgeon, having made it as plain as he could to his remaining faculty members that open warfare among the instructional staff would not be tolerated. His mood was lightened slightly at the sight of the person who awaited him there, the only member of his infernal court he'd seen fit to bring into the Orifice project. She had originally been the castellan of his palace in Sheol. Here in Orifice, her function was more akin to that of a provost or vice-chancellor, but since Castellan was the only name Akio had ever known her to claim, that was what he still called her. The Castellan was a Muspelite of indeterminate breed. Though attractive enough in a dark and pointy way, she was far too reserved to be a succubus and, Akio would have thought, not violent enough to be a pit fiend. All he really knew or cared to know about her was that she was very efficient, indifferent to the political maneuverings of his other underlings, and completely loyal. Loyal, unlike the others, by her very infernal design. Now she said, calmly as always, "Welcome back, my lord. How went your excursion to Midgard?" Akio seated himself behind his desk and sighed. "It had its moments," he replied. Nanami exceeded her instructions.
as expected? Inquired the Castellan.
Precisely as expected, said Accio with a satisfied smile. Then it switched off as he added grumpily, However, I'm not sure it was worth the trouble my absence invited. I swear I have fewer problems with the children than I have with the so-called adult supervision around here. He glanced up at her as she stepped to the end of his desk. I should have left you in charge while I was gone, not that imbecile Mikage.
Such an assignment would probably have violated my gesh of servitude, the Castellan pointed out a trifle primly. At any rate, it may help to know that I've completed my current research and found several very interesting prospects.
Accio raised an eyebrow. The children on Gerardo?
Yes, as you requested, I've identified several among them who have potential. However, the Castellan went on, placing a file folder on the blotter in front of him, much more interesting to me are these two, on Earth. Intrigued, Accio opened the folder. The first document he found inside it was a sheet of age-yellowed paper, enclosed in a glassine envelope to prevent damage from finger oils. It was covered in a cramped, spidery handwriting he couldn't read at a simple glance.
This record seems quite old, he observed.
It is old, the Castellan confirmed. It's from the journal of a man who died in 1941.
I told you before, no time travel, Accio snapped. The favors such an undertaking would require me to call in are much too costly.
None required, the Castellan told him, the very faintest trace of a smile touching her dusky red lips. They'll come to us. All we have to do is send someone to collect them.
She made a small gesture, indicating that he should look at the next page.
He did so, read it over twice, then sat back in his chair, looking intrigued in spite of himself.
Fine, he said. Toga can...
I recommend you not send Mr. Kiryu, my lord, interrupted the Castellan diplomatically. These particular prospects may tend to find him somewhat... alienating?
Accio looked through the file in silence for a few seconds. Yes, I see what you mean. Very well. Nanami can retrieve these two. I'll send Toga to assist Mikage with the Gerardo operation. For once in this enterprise, our resident wizard's peculiar expertise may actually prove useful.
He closed the file and slid it to his right. Very good, my lord, said the Castellan. She collected the folder and, with a slight bow, departed.